Let's take a trip to the moon. Come on, let's go for the moon. I wanna go to the moon. Let's take a trip to the moon. In the studio with us is Angelo De Grazia from the Space Association of Australia. Now, we spoke to Angelo several weeks ago, and he was in Florida. Well, tonight he's going to talk about his great American adventure. Welcome to the Space Show, Angelo.
Thank you, Andrew. Good to be here.
As we said, you've just been on a visit to the USA. Tell us about it, please.
Well, what can I say? I was a fill-in for Peter Ullwood, who's our president, as you know, but due to illness, he had to pull out. So I ended up wearing the Guernsey to go down to Florida and, at that stage, hopefully watch the launch of Artemis 1. Didn't actually work out that way, but it was nonetheless a pretty exciting time, I must say.
For those who haven't been listening to the Space Show the last few weeks, what's Artemis 1?
Okay, Artemis 1 is the new space launch system, which is a shuttle-derived new rocket. It's probably the most powerful flying rocket at the moment, ready to go, and it actually carries the Orion space capsule, which is unmanned for Artemis 1, but will be manned for Artemis 2 in a couple of years' time when they propose to do a Apollo 8 rerun. So it's a shuttle-derived heavy-lift rocket that essentially gets America back to the moon.
Oh, great. And when's it going to launch?
Well, I thought that when I was going to Florida, it was going to launch. I had booked in a flight and time in Florida to cover what was going to be three launch windows. There was a 28th launch window, the 2nd of September, the 28th of August, 2nd of September launch window, and the 5th of September. Well, it turns out that they didn't quite get to the second launch attempt, and they had to scrub due to leaks. But I can describe a little bit of the adventure, if you like. I came from the cold Melbourne winter and rolled up in Florida, and it was sitting at about 35 degrees every day with about 95% humidity. So it was shell-shocked on the first day.
A bit like flying from Melbourne up to northern Queensland.
Very, very similar. It reminded me of Cairns so much it wasn't funny. Anyway, so the first task was full of excitement and adrenaline. Go and get badged. Because I was there on as a media, I was able to go to the badging office, get my badges, and basically get ready to go. Now, because I was an international, what the drill was, you had to go to a particular facility just outside of Kennedy Space Center, congregate with all the international people, and then there would be a bus that would essentially take you into Kennedy Space Center into the media area. But as an international, you couldn't really walk around beyond the various boundaries that they had. So, for example, if you had to get lunch and you had to go to the NASA cafeteria, which was not far from the Vertical Assembly Building, you had to get escorted. So as international media, we were pretty well restricted. And just as by the by, if you read American reports on terrorism, the most likely terrorism is going to come from internal terrorists. So I thought it was a bit ironic that we were so closely scrutinized and monitored. Having said that, though, NASA treated us fantastically well. They were great.
And we have some pictures on our website, our Space Show website at space.southernfm.com.au, of you sitting in the auditorium listening to some of these press conferences.
Yeah, I did go to a couple, and they were pretty exciting. The thing that sticks in my mind about the trip, even though Artemis didn't launch, as we all know, was the heat, the humidity, number one. Two, the food. If you like fried food, you'd love America. But it can get a bit overwhelming. But the third thing was the amount of people that I met, and I met a lot of people from all walks of life, from astronauts, you know, to Bill Nelson. There's a picture of me with shaking hands with Bill Nelson, and but as well, we actually went and did some press conferences. We went to the press conferences because after every launch attempt, there'd be a number of press conferences, but there'd also be other press conferences for the European Space Agency's involvement in Artemis, for example. So, it was pretty full on. The time you were there, you were running around quite a bit.
And you got to see the rocket. You didn't see it go up, but you went and put a drive around it, I believe.
Okay. That was an interesting situation. Now, I learnt as part of the tricks of experience is that next time I go, I'm going to set up a camera. Because what happens if you set up a camera is NASA buses you to the launch site. And I befriended one of the chief, pad gurus there. He was he's a United States Air Force guy who was basically herding cats, which was the media, to go out to the pad every day to look after their cameras. And I managed to befriend him, and he actually took me on a trip. And I probably got to within, I'd say, about 400 metres of the rocket, 500 metres of the rocket. But I never got to go to the pad, which was my wish. But I got pretty close, and I got some really nice photos, and it's an awesome sight to see.
And at 300 metres away, you're looking at a 100-metre-tall rocket standing on a launch pad, which is even higher, you know.
That's probably about another 50 metres itself. Yeah.
Yes. So it's still pretty close.
It's pretty close. And as part of my travels, you know, I'd get around when I went to, say, Playa Linda Beach. You had another vantage point to see the rocket. And when you're on the beach, there's another vantage point. So I was able to get pictures on a number of vantage points, which really, amplified the enormity of the mission and the rocket. It was quite awe-inspiring, I must admit. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, we must say that the road that leads from Titusville down to Playa Linda Beach passes quite close to that launch pad.
Correct. And because it's 39B, from 39A, it was, you know, it's a lot further away. But when you're at 39B, it's very close. And interestingly enough, there's another pad which used to be the old Apollo 39C that they never built, which apparently SpaceX has got a dib in it, which means they may build a pad there, and that will be right next to Playa Linda Beach, right? So that's an interesting prospect. But, yeah, we were pretty close.
And outside of NASA, you saw other things at the Kennedy Space Center area?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, you don't go to the Kennedy Space Center without going to the visitor center. The visitor center is run by a private group, Delaware, something or other. But they do an excellent job. It costs you a packet to get in, $75, for example. But once you get in there, I got the yearly pass, incidentally, which was about $140 US, which meant I could go in and out when I wanted. But going in there, I was there 10 years ago when you went, Andrew, for STS-132. You were there for 131. And the place was a little bit run down, the visitor center, and the rocket garden that they have is an excellent thing to see, but was a bit run down. Now it's beautifully manicured, beautifully kept, well maintained. It's a real spectacle. So, yeah, costs you a few dollars to get in, but they do, with the money, they do a great job of preserving American heritage.
And they've got one of the three surviving space shuttles on display there.
Absolutely. And STS-132 back in May 2010 was Atlantis. And that's the space shuttle that's actually sitting inside the special building that is the Atlantis building, and brings a bit of a tear to your eye when you actually see it, because you knew that you watched it launch, You'd seen it in the sky many times, and you know, to be there on display was a real highlight for me. So was very sentimental.
And I remember seeing Atlantis up close and personal when I was there in the VAB, looking down on it from you know, one of the gantries inside the vehicle assembly building, and then seeing it roll out to the pad.
That would have been
what
awesome.
A magnificent sight. And then going the next morning out to the pad and meeting the astronauts who are going to fly an STS-132, right, standing right there beside the shuttle.
Look, I call it the luck of Atlantis, because STS-132 took off on time, landed on time, and we saw it all. We saw the boosters come in, we saw the landing, we saw everything. And it wasn't until some years later in Melbourne where I actually met one of the astronauts that flew on that mission, Antonelli, and got him to sign the autographs, of course, and and do exactly what the media shouldn't be doing. But he was terrific. And as I say, every time I'm associated with Atlantis, it's always a good thing. It's always the luck of Atlantis. So it was,
And it's nicely displayed, I believe.
Oh, beautifully displayed. And they have a show, and I don't want to, you know, sort of spoil the show, but there's a couple of shows that talks about the development of the space shuttle and whatever, and you go into these couple of rooms and you get the presentations, and then a door opens and you're in the building, and there's Atlantis staring you right in the face. And it's big. It's bigger than you think it is. And the most impressive sight, because it lies on its side with the cargo bay facing you as you walk in, right? So you've got the nose, the closest point to you, then you see the cargo bay. But as you walk around Atlantis and you go downstairs, you see the tiles of the Delta form wing, and it's excellent. It's, like I said, it's bigger than you think it is. And I remember watching the landing back in 2010 and in the early morning of 8:30 in the morning, watching this little dot come out of the sun and slowly swing around, and there was that Delta form looking at you as it swung around and then leveled off and came in to land on the shuttle runway. So seeing that up close and personal was, great.
And when I was there in 2010, and you in 2010, they had in Titusville, several kilometres away from the visitor centre, a Astronaut Hall of Fame.
Correct.
I believe it's now moved.
It has moved. And again, in 2010, it was a little bit of a rundown little building, and they had, you know, it kind of looked like space junk in every corner of the rooms that they had there. But now is a new building, and it's beautifully done. And it's quite impressive. They do podcasts from there, and they have I got talking to a guy that was an ex-pastor who was basically teaching kids technology, and he had his 3D printer, which he described in great detail to me, but he also showed the projects that he was doing and how he was really inspiring the young kids around Titusville on space and technology, and, you know, Arduino programming and all that sort of stuff. So I thought that was pretty cool. And the building itself is beautiful, and it's got a lot of nice stuff in it. You know, all space history in those few rooms. And, of course, they've got their souvenirs, like the various T-shirts and stuff that you, of course, buy and, you know, take them back to Melbourne with you to add to the, you know, the other 100 T-shirts that you've got, space-related T-shirts you've got at home.
Yes, I've never understood the fascination for T-shirts.
Yeah.
In Titusville, one of my favourite things there, Titusville, by the way, is just about 10 kilometres away from the Kennedy Space Centre, was the Spacewalk of Fame Museum. Did you go there?
Yeah. Well, it's called the American Space Museum, which is what I just described, but there's also the Spacewalk of Fame. And what it is there's three areas that are dedicated to the Mercury program, And it's just a little boulevard of trees, and you walk down and you see the various patches of the various missions, and it's just a nice, solemn place. They have a memorial to the American military there as well, and the fallen. But the Mercury one was really nicely done. You have the various handprints in stone and bronze and that sort of stuff,
and you can put your hands in the print.
You can, and my hands are bigger than John Glenn's. I know that because I tested it. And there's the Gemini part of it, and again it talks about it shows all the missions and has a memorial dedicated to them. And then you can go and do the Apollo. And so you see the Apollo missions. There's no shuttle one that I could see.
Yeah, so, it would be a bit hard, 135 of them.
Correct. I saw a lot of that stuff when I went to Houston. There's a lot of stuff on space shuttle there. But, it was good. So the other thing that I did while I was at Florida was I took a helicopter flight. There's a guy named Greg Scott who does a lot of the picture taking for Marcus House. People might know Marcus as an Aussie from Tasmania who actually does a great show every Saturday about the status of space flight, and he has people who work for him essentially and provide him input and data. Greg Scott is one of the photographers that does this. So what happens is he gets a helicopter, flies it out of Merritt Island up near Port Canaveral, and then he flies around Kennedy Space Center, and you can't fly over it, but you can fly around it, and he takes, with this super duper telephoto lens thing that he's got, he takes beautiful pictures of what's happening at pads 39A, 39B, what's happening down at the visitor center, what's happening down at the Roberts Road, SpaceX. We flew right over the top of that. And then, of course, what was happening at Port Canaveral. And there was all sorts of stuff happening that day. I couldn't believe it. We had a Dragon in the water. They were just testing, recovery of it. Then on the other side, they had a CST-100 in the water. And then a ship was unloading the Delta, one of the Delta side boosters for the last Delta 4 flight, heavy. And then on the other side, we had Falcon 9 that had just come back from, and we saw them unloading the fairings from Doug and Bob, right? The two ships for SpaceX. So it was all happening on Port Canaveral that day. And it was great just to fly around. So that was a bit of a highlight for me.
And you didn't need a press pass for that?
No, you didn't. You just need the contacts. One thing you learn in this game is it's not it's not what you know, it's who you know. And like I said, I met a lot of people, and I was able to take advantage of some of those people.
All right. Well, Angelo, we'll take a break now and we'll come back to you talking about Houston.
Southern FM.
The sounds of the Bayside.
Where you're listening to The Space Show. Our guest tonight is Angelo De Grazia from the Space Association of Australia. And on his trip to America, he went to Houston. Houston, we've got a problem. Fame. Okay, Angelo, what happened in Houston?
Okay, after the 8th of September, that was the time that I had allowed for being at Florida, I took a flight and went to Houston. And the idea to go to Houston was to actually get down to SpaceX, which is at Boca Chica, which is down at the Mexican border. So the first day I got there, I got there in the afternoon. The next day I spent a little bit of time just around Johnson Space Center, just on the outside, because they have a Falcon 9 on its side there, and you can actually see it, and they actually have a the 747 with a shuttle on top. Shuttle Independence sits on top of that, and you can actually see it. It's quite an awesome sight. So I spent the day just hovering around Houston. The next morning, I got the car, and I headed for south to the Mexican border for my 5.5-hour trip to Boca Chica. So I went past Galveston, Corpus Christi, into Brownsville. Now, I thought Brownsville was a bit like Seymour, you know, two-horse town. Nothing like it. It's more like Geelong. It's big, big city. So that was my first day for Houston. I wasn't there a long time, but at the same time that I was in Houston, Kamala Harris was there as well, the Vice President of the United States, and she was there to essentially run the Second Space Council that has been run by the Biden administration. And so I kind of bumped in. I didn't actually bump into her figuratively, but she was at Florida for the launch attempt number one. And then when I go to Houston, she was in Houston for the Space Council meeting.
So you're a Kamala Harris groupie?
Oh, I wouldn't go that far, but she seems to follow me around.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to take a listen to what Kamala said at the National Space Council? And you might want to comment on
Sure.
some of the things she said.
Soon, for the first time in half a century, America will go back to the moon. The Artemis program will return American astronauts to the lunar surface. Yes. And as Madam Director mentioned, it will include the first woman and person of color. And think about it. So when we went before, indeed with pride, we planted our flag. It was rather temporary, that visit. With the Artemis program, it's not just to visit, but to live and to work on the moon. Think about that. The Artemis program, yes. The Artemis program will establish the first space station in lunar orbit and the first lunar base camp, where astronauts will train for the first mission to Mars. And our nation is also leading the way in human space exploration closer to home. For over two decades, astronauts aboard the International Space Station have advanced scientific progress. In fact, I was honored to speak with three of them this morning, from here, of course. NASA has used the station's unique microgravity environment to develop new treatments for cancer and rare genetic diseases. And when I spoke with them this morning, they talked about how their work is helping us fight the climate crisis. Their work is increasing the productivity of our farms and slowing the effects of aging. So our administration and we all gathered today are committed to continuing that work, which is why last year our administration announced that we would extend our commitment to the International Space Station through 2030. And that being said, we are aware that the International Space Station will not remain operational forever, that we all know. Which is why NASA is working with the private sector to develop the first generation of commercial space stations. And as we will discuss more today, our administration remains committed to making sure that NASA maintains the capacity to conduct cutting-edge research in space. Which brings me then to our final area of focus: establishing rules for novel commercial space activities. Today, private space companies have capabilities that would have been difficult to imagine even a decade ago. Today, private companies can dock satellites in orbit. They can capture and move space debris out of the way of our satellites and space stations. And soon, they will be able to repair and even build new structures while in orbit.
That was Kamala Harris, the chair of the United States National Space Council. She also happens to be Vice President of the United States, speaking in Houston. Now, Angelo, you were there, but not there.
I was in Houston and she was there, but the security around Kamala is quite amazing. So it'd be very hard to get into to a meeting like that. But look, obviously everything she said was music to all our space fans' ears. I mean, she made a solid commitment to going back to the moon. That was articulated through the Artemis project. She also made a commitment to keeping the space station going till 2030. She also made a commitment to privatising space stations. Mm. They're very significant things that will hold us, you know, in good stead for the next 20 years in space. So my only, maybe I'm a cynic, the only thing is always predicated on, I hope the money is where the mouth is.
Yep, always. No bucks, no bang.
That's it. No bucks, no Buck Rogers. Famous line from The Right Stuff.
Yes, certainly. Speaking of the space station, is there any update on Russia and its intentions with the space station?
Not that I'm aware of. That's a daily motion. I believe the special operations in Russia are now going to increase into full mobilisation of its reserves. So it becomes more and more unlikely that the Americans will cooperate with the Russians and vice versa. So I know that every time something like this happens, Elon Musk holds up his hands and says, if you want to boost the space station, I'm ready to go. So if Russia pulls out, they lose that boosting capability and therefore they need to replace that somehow. But clearly for Kamala to commit to 2030, they've got a plan because they know that the Russians may or may not pull out. And I know that if they do pull out, they're not just going to crash the space station into the sea.
Mm. Now, one of the contenders for a private space station, of course, is Axiom. And Australia has an agreement with Axiom to fly astronauts, provided we pay.
Oh, well, I'm sure NASA would fly them. Just a little bit of a sidetrack. I was impressed when I was at Florida to see the contingent of ESA astronauts, one of them who I met personally because he's Luca Parmitano, who's, you know, obviously me being Italian heritage, he's one person that I would congregate to, and he was a lovely gentleman, but there was also Canadians there as well. So we had ESA people from France, from Italy, from Germany, and we had astronauts from Canada. And it turns out that in Artemis 2, we're going to have two Americans go up and one Canadian and one ESA astronaut. So they obviously are paying their way through either direct contributions or work in kind, like Europeans provide the service module, the Canadians provide the Canada arm and various other things. So if Australia wanted to pay, I'm sure that NASA would be more than obliging to give us a seat. And interestingly enough, whilst I was there in Florida, we had Enrico from the Australian Space Agency there. I didn't see him. He didn't come into the media area, but he was in Florida at the time, which is really good. And you know, of course, we have a real connection with NASA because Pamela Malroy, who's now the deputy administrator, had a hand in helping write reports to the government of the time in the establishment of the Australian Space Agency. So, you know, Australia is looked upon favourably And if we wanted to pay for a seat, I'm sure NASA would oblige us.
And the European astronaut on Artemis 2 is now official, because I heard the ESA Director General just a couple of weeks ago saying it hadn't been decided.
Yeah, and I, as far as I'm concerned, it hasn't been decided. But if you know something, Andrew, I'd love to hear it. But you'll find that none of the Artemis 2 astronauts have been either American or internationals have been declared yet. And certainly the one that we're all waiting for is Artemis 3, which is the landing on the moon. Now, there is one coloured lady, and you've got to think that she...
I won't say her name, but I've got a name in my mind.
Yes, I can't remember her name either, but you've got to bet that she's going to be hot favourite, because one of Artemis's objectives is to land the first person of colour and the first woman.
And she ticks both boxes.
And she ticks both boxes, so it'd be the perfect outcome.
Anyway, we won't say her name because it may not happen. Now, while you're in Houston, you met a New Zealander.
I did. I met a guy called Mana Vortia. He's a terrific guy. We met him back in 2010. In those days, he worked as a contractor for NASA, and he wanted to be an astronaut. Well, it turns out 10 years later, he still wants to be an astronaut, so he's going to apply one more time, see if he can get in. But he is an interesting guy. He's a guy from our part of the neck of the woods, you know. He's the cousin just on the other side of the ditch, and he's now an American. And he works in as an integration engineer, and he has worked on Orion and human landing system integration, as well as gateway integration and various other systems. He works for Booz Allen, and he's quite a character. We went out to a Texas barbecue one night, and he introduced me to the local cuisine. So that was quite an interesting night. But he's an interesting character, and we should, as part of the space show, get an interview with him and put it up. He's one of the local boys that has done good, and we ought to acknowledge him for that.
Okay. And you went down, as you said, to Boca Chica. What
I did.
What's the big attraction down there?
Big rockets. Big rockets. Once you drive to Brownsville, that's the local town that's not far from the Rio Grande, which is the Mexican border, you then drive another half an hour towards what is called Boca Chica. A lot of people like to call it Starbase, right? That's the name that Elon has given to it. And essentially you drive 30 minutes down the road, and you come... There's this fantastic YouTube video, and I would recommend it to anyone to watch it. And it's a drive through Boca Chica, but with a 360-degree camera, which means that as you drive, you can actually use your mouse to turn the vision as you're driving. Incredible. So I'd watched that a few times, so I knew exactly where I was going and what I was doing. But down there, the first thing you'll come to is the production site. Now, as soon as you get there, probably about 5 minutes, 8 minutes before you get to Boca Chica, you start to see the buildings, the various high bays that they integrate the rockets into. And then you drive into that area, you turn left, and you drive to the end of the road, and you come to what people call the Rocket Garden. I think SpaceX call it the graveyard. But there you have three Starships sitting on the ground, and one Super Heavy sitting there. You know, the SN-15, SN-20, I think it was Booster 6. And they're huge. Fantastic. But you're literally 6 metres away. Incredible. So I've got pictures of those that I'm planning to show at the Space Association meeting next Monday. So once you go through there, then you drive a further 5 minutes and you go to the launch pads itself. Now, a few days before, they'd actually test fired all six engines of Starship number 24, SN-24, and they set the paddock on fire as they usually do. But it was hung from a crane, and they were going through its testing process. And going a bit further down, you saw the Super Heavy or Booster 8 sitting there that has since had 7 engines fire in a static fire, which is pretty amazing, but they haven't yet lit all 33 engines, which is, I believe, probably a couple of weeks away. They're going to fire those. At that point, they're going to probably be ready to start stacking and maybe launch, have a crack at launching before the end of the year into orbit, which will be a fantastic sight.
That many engines worries me because the Soviet Union tried a big moon rocket called the N1, and it had about 30-something engines on it, and that was a big problem for the Russians.
That's true, but you also got to remember that Falcon Heavy has 27 engines, and we've always had successful Falcon Heavy flights. Not that we've had many, but... you know, the technology is so much more advanced than when the N1s were flying back in the late 60s than, Elon believes that, that number of engines gives him the ability of flexibility, because if a couple of engines have a problem, he's got others to rely on. And the other thing, too, is that he's now building protective cages around the engines so that if one actually explodes and blows up, it doesn't affect the engines around it. And there was a recent test in McGregor in Texas, a SpaceX engine testing facility, where they deliberately blew an engine up to see what impact it has on the containment vessel around it. So, look, it's pretty amazing. And the thing that surprised me was that from the launch site, you can drive another, 50 metres and you're at the beach. Now, I thought... there'd be a bit of rubbish on the beach and there wouldn't be anybody there. And, it was all a big hoo-ha about the locals protesting about access to the beach, right, which was part of the controversy of the FAA licensing to SpaceX to launch. Well, I was wrong. I went down there and the beach was clean, but it was full of people. People drive their cars onto the beach and they set up their little... marquees and things and have a good time. And, and who wouldn't in 35 degrees, humid as hell. All the pelicans were enjoying it too. So I was shocked by the proximity of the beach and the people to the rocket launching site.
So for people who haven't seen pictures of the Starship, can you paint a visual picture for us?
All right. Starship is a 9-metre cylindrical bullet, and it has two fins on the bottom and two fins at the top. They are there for what's called the belly flop into the atmosphere. Those flaps work concurrently to keep the ship in a particular angle during re-entry. It's covered by tiles on one side and it's stainless steel on the other. It has 6 engines, 3 atmospheric Raptors, and they're Raptor 2s now. They're not the Raptor 1s. The Raptor 2s are significantly more advanced engines that SpaceX has developed, and they have 3 vacuum optimized engines, and they are the ones that have the extended bells, exhaust bells that optimize for vacuum. They test fired those, but that particular version, SN24, that's sitting there also has a slot cut in the side, and the slot in the side, the top of the nose cone, is for Starlink 2. Dispenser. What happens is the slot opens up and they shoot out the Starlinks out of a dispenser that's loaded internally out of the out of the rocket.
The cockroaches of the sky.
Yeah.
And so the plan for the first flight is to do less than an orbit around?
It is less than an orbit. The idea is that, and they're still talking about it, of bringing the booster back actually to, I don't know how much people know of the SpaceX system, but there's a launch tower and it's got what's called chopsticks on it, and they are protruding arms from the tower. The idea is that the booster will return to those chopsticks and actually the chops land on the chopsticks. So there is talk that on the first flight they might even give that a go rather than drop it into the Gulf of Mexico. So watch this space as to how that develops. The second part of it, which is the Starship, will then fire and continue on all the way to Hawaii. Not quite an orbit, three quarters of an orbit, and then it will basically do its re-entry and then splash down in Hawaii where it'll just land in the sea. But obviously they'll gain a lot of data out of it. In the meanwhile, I think they're going to try to deliver a Starlink satellite.
So it'll head off east across Florida and the Atlantic, Africa, and the Indian Ocean and the and then splash down in the Pacific.
Correct. It'll be quite a demonstration. My money is end of the year. However, there's still the elephant in the room called the FAA, right? And the FAA need to provide a license. Now, in order to do that, SpaceX have to comply with something like 85 or thereabouts conditions, and some of the conditions are quite extensive. Again, something that surprised me, but the last battle of the American Civil War in 1865 actually occurred there. The Confederates won that, but that was 30 days after Lee had surrendered up north. So there was a focus by the FAA for the historical aspects of that region to be preserved by SpaceX. So they're required to write reports and do all sorts of things in relation to that. That's amongst other things.
So an exciting time coming up.
Very.
Well, Angelo, we'll be back with you in a moment. And diary time coming up, folks. So get your diary handy. We have an event for you to attend.
Nothing's interrupted our lives more than COVID-19.
Wow.
88.3 Southern FM.
On air and online via the free Community Radio Plus app. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play.
Joining us is Angelo De Grazia from the Space Association of Australia. And as Angelo mentioned, he's going to be talking on Monday, September the 26th. Angelo, what's happening?
Well, I've done a couple of interviews here, obviously, for my trip, but this time, for the Space Association, I'm going to put some pictures to the story. So I'll pull out all the happy snaps that I took while I was there and put them into a PowerPoint presentation and present that to the Space Association and give a story as I go. So the pictures are pretty good, and I'm sure people will, you know, get the feel of what I'm talking about when I verbalise it, but they can actually see the pictures. Which are excellent.
Well, we look forward to that. And also at that meeting will be the Melbourne Space Program. Now, they are a group that is spun up out of Melbourne University, and they're building small satellites. They already have one in orbit, and they're building another one now called Acrux 2. And they'll be talking about what they're doing there. So this is on Monday, September the 26th. Between 7 o'clock, that's 7 p.m., and 9:30 p.m. at the Golden Gate Hotel. The Golden Gate Hotel is at 238 Clarendon Street. That's on the corner with Coventry Street in South Melbourne. Now, just a little word of caution. The venue, unfortunately, is not disabled friendly, so you will need to be able to climb a flight of stairs. If you'd like to join us beforehand at 6 p.m. In the downstairs area, we'll be having meals with, you know, you can purchase meals. Now, there's no charge for the meeting. It's free, but you will have to pay for the meals and drinks if you have them downstairs between 6 and 7 p.m. So this is Monday, September the 26th. The meeting itself is from 7 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. and it's at the Golden Gate Hotel, 238 Clarendon Street, on the corner with Coventry Street, right there in South Melbourne. So please, please come and join us and hear what Angelo has to say. We're just going to bring Angelo back on again because he's got an update on the Artemis mission.
Okay, Andrew. Tonight, you can tune in to NASA and watch them perform a cryo test on the hydrogen fuel system, which they fixed over the past week or so. And hopefully if that works, then the first available opportunities is 27th of this month for a potential launch. There's one caveat to that, of course. They have to obtain approval from the Eastern Range due to the flight termination system batteries. If they don't get that, they're going to have to take the rocket back to the VAB.
Thank you, Angelo. And you've been listening to The Space Show here on Sullen FM.